Before we start the show, I wanted to tell y'all about a special virtual live event that I'll be participating in. The Thursday after this episode releases, June 30th, 2022, at 7:30 p.m. Central Time, I'll be joining Laura from the podcast The Fall Line, Sarah from the podcast Voices for Justice, and our friend Arlene to discuss her uncle Leon Laralis's 1996 murder. This should be a pretty informative gig, and will likely include several updates on Arlene's unfortunate struggle to get law enforcement's cooperation, and possibly some other updates as well. So please join us, again Thursday, June 30th, 2022, at 7:30 p.m. Central, for this free live event. I'll put a link in the episode's show notes where you can register to participate. Hope to see y'all there. Now, onto the show.
The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Not a day goes by that Jody doesn't think of her Aunt Carol. Whoever murdered Carol Pressler in June of 1988 has evaded justice for 34 years. Her brutal death at that person's hands, of course, changed the life trajectory of those who loved her. Jody's mother, Susie, suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder and feelings of guilt for not being there to protect her little sister. Her mother's struggle with grief and the irrationality that it often brings affected Jody and her family immeasurably, but Jody also grieves for the loss of her mother's sister, her Aunt Carol, who she knew well.
She was like the fun aunt because she was not that much, you know, older than us. And she was the one where if your mom said you couldn't have something, you know, she would chase the ice cream truck because yes, you could have ice cream from the ice cream truck. Or, you know, when we were getting older, we wanted, back then it was like everyone wanted a pair of Guess jeans. Well, no, you can't have them. They're too expensive. So she would buy those for us. You know, she was a very generous, like big-hearted person.
In 2013, after many calls, Jody finally convinced Fort Worth homicide / cold case detective Carrie Adcock to take on her Aunt Carol's murder case.
What Adcock did in 2013, he was my last ally in Fort Worth PD before he left the cold case unit. And I just pleaded with him until he finally worked on her case just to shut me up. But, I know he did it the old school way. Like he went through everything, read everything, took a fresh look at it, came up with groups of suspects, prioritized them.
Detective Adcock worked the case doggedly and diligently, but was ultimately unsuccessful. It wasn't for a lack of trying, as Jody said. The policeman was responsible for the most activity on Carol's case since the initial investigation. Still as determined as she ever has been to see justice for her aunt, Jody continued phoning cold case detectives at the Fort Worth Police Department after Adcock retired. This is Detective Leah Wagner of the Fort Worth Police.
So as you know, here at Fort Worth PD, we have close to about 1,000 cold cases. And one of the ways that we usually come across those cases is the family. You know, they will call and they'll reach out and they'll say, hey, I don't know if you're aware of this case, but this is what happened to my loved one. You know, they'll give the approximate date and what happened and they'll tell me about that case. Well, in this instance with Carol Pressler, her niece Jody contacted me. She told me that she'd last been in contact with Detective Adcock when he was here at the homicide unit. And that they had kind of, you know, worked together to try to figure out some ways to open up new leads or point to suspects for Carol's case. And she said she hadn't heard from a detective since then.
This was not unusual, Detective Wagner explained. When a detective retires or leaves a unit and another takes their place, they may or may not choose to continue the work of their predecessor. This is especially true, of course, of cold cases.
We do have the ability to pick cases at will, so I don't have to work a case that somebody else worked. I can pick and choose what I want. But, you know, we still listen to the families, still see what they have to say and see if there's anything that we can do for them. So in this instance, when Jody and I spoke about it, I said, well, let me see what I can find in regards to your aunt's case, and then we'll start from there. So I pulled Carol's case file, and just to give you an idea of what some of these cases look like, our average cases are in a brown expandable folder, which is usually anywhere from 4 to maybe 6 inches thick. And that's an average case. There are some that are much thinner than that. There are some that have double that volume. And then there are the box cases. And the box cases are the ones that they have so much information that they just couldn't be contained in a file folder, so they had to move it to a box. Well, Carol's was one of the box cases.
Prior detectives, both those who were involved in the initial investigation in 1988 and those who'd picked up the case in the decades since, had collected a significant amount of information and leads. Upon exploring the large case file, Detective Wagner discovered that there was plenty to work with, and the investigation into the 1988 murder of Carol Pressler was reopened.
So my whole thing is too, like, I'm just big on justice. And for me, it's just like, well, I'm not going to quit trying until I'm dead. And I believe it could be solved strongly. She was a student, a sister, a daughter, an aunt. You know, she had a little dog. She had her own life, you know. She didn't get to get married, have kids. She was deprived of all of that.
Carol Lee Pressler was born in Tarrant County, Texas, on September 22, 1960, to parents Mary and Hosea Pressler. She was the last of three girls born to the couple. The middle child was Beth, and the oldest girl was Susie.
We come from a family of three girls, and Carol was, I was like 10 when she was born, so she was an only child a little bit in a way, and I kind of thought she was mine. I mean, you know, you have a doll that laughs and cries and drinks the milk. Well, I thought this was real and it was mine. And I mean, we were so excited about her and really enjoyed her as a baby.
Before Carol came along, both Susie and Beth spent a considerable portion of their time at their grandparents' house, which was right next door when they were growing up. Not long after Carol was born, the Presslers moved. Though they were still in the Fort Worth area, they now lived a little further away from the girls' grandparents. The bond Beth and Susie developed with their paternal grandparents was hard on their mother Mary, perhaps, and as they continued to spend a significant amount of their time there, little Carol was often looked after by her maternal grandmother, who, for a time, took on helping raise her. It's unnecessary to expound upon the reasons and circumstances that contributed to Carol, Beth, and Susie's relatively unconventional childhoods, but the kids were often left to their own devices while at home with mom and dad. It was much the same situation with Carol when she was under the care of her maternal grandmother. As Carol's personality began to show and strengthen, which did not take long, it showed in a big way.
And my mom encouraged Carol to be kind of outrageous. You know, the more out of bounds her behavior was, the more amusing my mother found it to be.
Carol was funny, extremely bright, spirited, and enjoyed entertaining whoever was around. And everyone adored her. Coming into her teens, Carol had become a little more than her grandmother could handle. As much as Carol's strong personality was adored and egged on when she was a young girl, Such a thing can become a problem later down the line, as anyone who's ever raised a teenager knows firsthand. And Carol, well, again, she was spirited.
So Carol was kind of left to her own devices without good modeling. And all of the positive feedback that she got for that kind of behavior when she was young, when she got to be kind of a pre-teenage kind of age, it wasn't so amusing anymore. And my mom was divorced from my dad at this point. And my mom put her in, I think it was called St. Michael's in Dallas. Aside from just having a hard time dealing with all she was dealing with, which is understandable given the background, she was pretty innocent, and she went to St. Michael's with a lot of kind of hardcore girls that were not a good influence on her. So that wasn't a great move either. The claim was nobody gets thrown out of there. And Carol said, oh, I'll show you. And she got thrown out of there.
Carol, it seems, was growing unhappy or perhaps impatient with her mother's busy social life. Her sister Susie remembered stories of Carol ever so slightly pushing Mom's car keys behind the dresser so she couldn't find them after getting gussied up for a night on the town. Around 1976, Mary was apparently at her wit's end with the outrageous and stubborn child she'd helped sculpt Carol into.
My mom worked for Federal Aviation, and she went to California, took a job with FAA in which California. She'd always wanted to travel, and Carol desperately wanted to go with her and promised that she would obey all the rules, do as she was asked, make good grades, which she was real capable of. Carol was smart. But my mom just would not do it. And I said, please, please take her. If she even looks at you crossways, put her on a plane and send her to me. But she's not going to ever forgive you if you don't take her. But she didn't take her.
So Carol, who was 16 years old at the time, moved from the Fort Worth, Texas suburb of Euless to her sister Susie's place in Ogden, Utah. Susie was in her mid-20s and married with a young child, but the sisters were very close, and the family welcomed Carol's company. As a baby, Susie felt that Carol was hers, and now she was her sister's guardian, raising her and guiding her through the remainder of her teenage years and into young adulthood. During her time there, Carol also became close with her nieces. After graduating from high school in Ogden, Carol attended Weber State University and then went on to enroll at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. There, she began working at a brokerage and quickly became enamored with the world of buying, selling, and trading stocks, a profession that Carol could have easily thrived in, considering her amiable, outgoing, and witty personality and charm. Susie, who was essentially Carol's mother figure, wasn't crazy about the idea of her little sister moving in with a boyfriend in Salt Lake City. But she wasn't there long anyway before she realized her friends there weren't who she thought they were. She and her boyfriend, too, went through a bad breakup. It was time for a fresh start. Home was calling her back. The many responsibilities we take on, whether we need to or not, most often push having fun to the bottom of our lists. However often you let yourself actually enjoy something, I'm going to hazard a guess that it's not enough. There's an easy remedy, the adventure puzzle game Best Fiends. It's no problem to just pick up your mobile device and knock out a few levels of Best Fiends whenever you have a minute, allowing yourself to utilize every second of free time for fun. I'm all the way up to level 5824, and I'm still having a blast. You can play offline, and collecting rewards and building your slug-busting army is pretty cool. You've earned your fun time. Go to the Apple App Store or Google Play to download Best Fiends for free. Plus, earn even more with $5 worth of in-game rewards when you reach level 5. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. A while after moving back to Fort Worth in 1983, Carol Pressler enrolled at the University of Texas Arlington, or UTA, to continue her education before pursuing a career as a stockbroker. To help finance both school and the cost of living, Carol took a job waiting tables at Feather's Lounge, located in the Green Oaks Inn, just off Interstate 30 in West Fort Worth. Back in her hometown, Carol was in her natural, most comfortable environment. But like many who leave a place and come back, the expectations didn't quite match reality. Between work and school, there was little time, but Carol was young and incredibly lively, and she wasn't about to waste that youth with things like sleeping, apparently. She had some old friends and made a few new ones, including a 39-year-old man named Woody, who 24-year-old Carol began dating sometime in 1985, just after a terrible breakup. Carol's new beau was a successful business owner with a nice house in West Fort Worth. He was generous and looked out for her, and likely spoiled her a bit. She described him as a big teddy bear to her niece Jody. Woody, being 15 years older than Carol, was protective of her, but according to Carol's family, it wasn't in an overbearing or possessive way. Rather, this behavior was loving and more the fatherly type. Though Woody and Carol's relationship was described as sort of on-again, off-again, the couple got along well by all accounts. In fact, by 1988, 3 years into the relationship, Carol was rarely at her Southwest Fort Worth apartment, as she chose to spend most of her time at Woody's place in Benbrook. On Thursday, June 23, 1988, 27-year-old Carol Lee Pressler worked a shift at Feather's Lounge. After work, Carol and a coworker named Belinda headed to the Wild West Club, located at Highway 80 and Las Vegas Trail, just a couple miles southwest of Feathers. They hung out there a while before taking the party back to Belinda's apartment, which took them into the early morning hours of Friday, June 24th. According to Belinda, Carol left at 2:30 a.m., presumably to go home. It was the last time anyone is known to have seen her. Beginning at about 3 a.m., just 30 minutes after Carol was last seen at her coworker Belinda's place, Carol's downstairs neighbor at the Harbor Club Apartments awoke to noises coming from her unit above. He described what he heard as banging and the sounds of a woman screaming and crying. It kept him up until around 4:30 a.m., when he was finally able to get back to sleep. When the neighbor woke up at 7 a.m., he later told police, the sounds of a woman sobbing could still be heard. At around 8:30 that morning, he heard Carol's door close, and upon peeking out his window, saw a man leaving the apartment. This man walked downstairs to the parking lot and placed something into a red car before returning to Carol's. The sounds that had kept him up for hours earlier that morning stopped after the man went back in. This witness didn't call 911 to report the noises he heard, he later said, because he thought it was a domestic squabble, and he'd been physically assaulted for calling police another time about an unrelated matter. Meanwhile, Carol's sister Susie had traveled from Ogden, Utah, to Fort Worth for a visit. She arrived at her paternal grandma Edith's house early Friday morning. It was common for Susie and her daughters to travel to Texas a couple times a year to see Carol and Edith, usually during the Christmas holiday and the kids' summer break. Though she was supposed to have arrived a few days earlier, Susie had a hard time getting the trip started and came in a little late. Carol had been calling Edith's for a few days, anxious for her big sister's arrival. But by the time Susie got to her grandmother's, the calls had stopped. At first, Susie thought it would be fun to just show up at Carol's apartment to surprise her, but ultimately decided not to, since she had her youngest child with her. That afternoon, Carol's boyfriend Woody, 42 years old, drove by her apartment and saw her car in the parking lot. He hadn't seen Carol for a couple days, which he said was unusual, and presumably seeing her car there quelled any immediate worries he might have had. Carol's sister Susie, too, continued to call her apartment repeatedly into Friday evening, but she still wasn't answering. Susie could feel something was wrong. Woody, too, became increasingly worried that night because Carol missed a date with him and another couple. By the following morning, Saturday, June 25th, 1988, Susie and Woody's worry had become too much to bear. They both had keys to Carol's apartment, but decided Woody should be the one to head over and check on her. At about 9 a.m., Carol Pressler's boyfriend climbed the stairs to the second story and arrived at her apartment to make sure she was okay. He unlocked the door and entered, and it was immediately obvious that things were terribly wrong. After walking through to her room, Woody found Carol's partially clothed, badly beaten, and bloodied body lying on her bed. Woody hurriedly made his way to the apartment manager's office. Too panicked and shaken to make the call to police, Woody asked the manager to phone 911. When the manager hung up with the emergency operator, Woody phoned Carol's grandmother, Edith's house. Edith answered. She spoke with Woody for a moment, before turning to Susie to hand her the phone. Susie knew right away that the call was the worst imaginable news. She'd felt it the day before, when Carol wasn't answering her calls.
But I knew, because she'd been calling my grandmother looking for me, when I couldn't reach her, I just knew. There's a feeling that, I don't know, you just feel it. And when the phone rang the next morning, and Edith was calling me to the phone, I walked backwards away from the phone and didn't want to go, because there's just a sense in you, like when you're looking for somebody and you should be able to find them and you can't, it just felt like this extreme sense of quiet.
Susie would hold on to the notion that had she just gone to surprise her sister, she could have saved her. After calling 911 to report what the man had found, the Fort Worth police arrived at the apartment of Carol Pressler at 9:44 a.m. Detective Leah Wagner described to us what the police walked into.
Without giving too many details, the scene was pretty brutal. I mean, whoever had done that to Carol, actually, it looks like they terrorized her prior to actually killing her. That's how bad it was. And it's one of those that, you know, my partner and I have talked about it and how, you know, we see a lot of people get murdered and a lot of it is some sort of retaliation killing, whether it's drugs or it's a domestic relationship or whatever. But whoever did this to Carol meant to just, I mean, they wanted to demean her before she died. It was absolutely terrible.
Susie also arrived outside the scene of her sister's murder. But before she could enter, responding officers stopped and detained her. The Tarrant County Medical Examiner determined at autopsy that 27-year-old Carol Pressler had been strangled to death. Medical investigator J.R. Helm determined that Carol's time of death was no earlier than dusk on Friday, June 24, 1988, suggesting that even after her neighbor stopped hearing banging noises and the sounds of a woman sobbing, Carol remained alive for hours, a belief that not everyone familiar with the case shares. Though the injuries Carol endured while she was tortured go far beyond her cause of death, as Detective Wagner suggested, those have not been publicly released. Few articles about Carol's murder saw print in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and even fewer on local television news stations. But the few that did specifically one published more than a decade later, gave some insight into what was found at the crime scene. Carol Pressler had been gagged, terrorized, and raped with an undisclosed object before she was strangled to death. Though it was not specified exactly where, a palm print and writings were found on the walls of her apartment. These writings were described to us as extremely derogatory in nature. Whoever killed Carol also took her phone and answering machine, likely what her neighbor saw the man put in a red car before coming back to her unit. Considering these details, Fort Worth homicide detectives theorized that whoever committed this abhorrent act was someone Carol knew. Folks who lived in the Harbor Club apartment complex commented that they didn't even know anyone lived in Carol Pressler's unit, prompting the Fort Worth Star-Telegram to publish an article titled, "Quiet Woman Dies at Hands of a Strangler." Nothing, however, could be farther from the truth. Carol was a vivacious and energetic woman, mischievous and fun-loving. She'd been that way, her paternal grandmother Edith Pressler said, since she was a baby. She'd certainly never been thought of as quiet. There was a good reason folks didn't know Carol lived at her unit. She took classes at UTA, worked nights at Feathers Lounge, and spent most of her time off at her boyfriend Woody's house. If she wasn't at Woody's for his company, Carol was there doting on her little Yorkshire Terrier, Georgie, who stayed at her boyfriend's. Edith, who had visited her granddaughter the week before her murder, told a reporter that everyone liked Carol, a sentiment echoed by co-workers, friends, and other relatives, many who attended her funeral service on Wednesday, June 29, 1988. The Greenwood Funeral Home was packed that day. Due to the injuries Carol sustained, the service was closed casket. Not wanting Carol to be alone, her grandmother Edith offered to share her plot without hesitation, and she was buried at Greenwood Memorial Park next to her grandfather. Edith was later buried in the same grave and shares a headstone with Carol. Since he had discovered Carol Pressler's body, was romantically involved with her, and since most homicides are perpetrated by someone close to the victim, Woody was a suspect in her murder right away.
That's what they did. They focused on her boyfriend, which makes sense, but maybe at the exclusion of other people, because she did come in contact with a lot of people because she was a student. She worked at Feathers. And so there were just a lot of people that she came in contact with.
Jody also pointed out that Woody passed a polygraph test. However, police concentrated their investigative efforts on him to the point that it was detrimental to the case itself, Carol's family believes. It's unclear if certain other leads were ever followed to their potential inclusion or elimination, such as an incident that happened soon after Carol's slaying at her place of employment, Feathers Lounge. Just after she was killed, a worker there discovered something shocking and sick. In the bathroom, someone unknown drew a depiction of Carol murdered. Exact details of this incident are unknown to us, such as the exact nature of the drawing and writing, and the date it happened. Because it was disturbing and upset employees there, it was cleaned off the wall quickly. It was well before we had the ability to take pictures of everything instantly with our cell phones, and it's thought that a photo of it does not exist, that the cops never actually saw it. Still, the incident is thought to have been reported to police in 1988, and both the writings/drawing on the bathroom wall at Feathers Lounge and the subsequent reporting of it happened a decade before the public knew about the writing on the wall at the crime scene, Carol Pressler's apartment. There were also certainly other avenues to explore that perhaps went overlooked or ignored before the case was reinvestigated over a decade later. But until then, the investigation had long gone cold. In 2001, Fort Worth homicide detective Mike Carroll's investigation hit the ground running, and potential progress was made fast. The detective noticed a few things in the file that immediately caught his attention. First, he saw that back in 1988, the Harbor Club apartment manager had reported suspicious behavior by a man who lived a couple doors down from Carroll. The manager witnessed this man, who we'll call Michael Butler, taking photographs of a Harbor Club complex employee who was standing by her car. Another woman who was visiting a neighbor a few days before the murder also reported that she had seen a man who matched Butler's description, hiding in the shadows near Carroll's apartment door. However, Butler, who was in his mid-20s at the time of the murder, was never questioned in the initial investigation. Upon re-interviewing Carroll Pressler's downstairs neighbor, the witness who'd seen a man leave the slain woman's apartment, place something in a red car, and then return, Detective Carroll discovered the description of this man also matched the description of Michael Butler. When shown a photo lineup, the neighbor witness chose Butler's picture as the man he saw. On Thursday, September 27, 2001, 41-year-old Michael Butler, who was living in Garland, was arrested and charged with the 1988 murder of his neighbor, 27-year-old Carroll Lee Pressler. The man professed his innocence from the get-go, but the capital murder charge required a high bail, which was set at $100,000, and of which the man paid the bond and was released. For months, evidence in Carroll's case sat at the Fort Worth Police Crime Lab untested, along with the evidence from many other crimes. There were several understandable reasons for this, in addition to the hundreds of cases from Fort Worth that required testing. The lab also received evidence from the surrounding jurisdictions that together form what is known as the Mid-Cities. They even tested evidence from neighboring Johnson County. The problem was that while cases from Fort Worth sat and collected dust, mid-cities like North Richland Hills were getting results back in 2 to 3 weeks. It took until February of 2002 to get crime scene evidence from Carroll's case and from Michael Butler to testing, after her sister Susie contacted news outlets with her concerns. But there was another problem that had nothing to do with testing. The Tarrant County District Attorney's Office had problems with the case against Butler from the beginning. Relying on the 13-year-old memory of a neighbor and not much else wasn't going to fly, and Assistant DA George Miller, who was surprised intake accepted the case against Butler at all, refused to take it before a grand jury before DNA testing was done. The case never came before a grand jury. Interestingly, it was reported by the Fort Worth Star-Telegram in 2001 that Susie had a run-in with Butler in the days after her sister's murder. But Susie does not recognize the man she saw as Butler at all.
There was a man who approached me in the parking lot as I was cleaning out her apartment, and there was a red sports car mentioned in the initial investigation and looking around right after it happened. And I had a red sports car, and his demeanor was just odd. He looked at me almost like he was seeing a ghost. And at the time, Carroll and I looked a bit alike. And he came up to me in the parking lot, and he said, "You know, they have not talked to me about this, and it makes no sense that they wouldn't talk to me about this. I should have been talked to. Why wasn't I talked to?" And I just thought it was so strange. So I immediately called the police, and then when I asked them about it, they said, "Oh, we talked to him, we cleared him, it's nothing." But when they looked back in the file, they did not talk to him. They did not find him, they did not talk to him. They simply placated me by telling me that they did.
Susie had given the cops this person's license plate number and description during the initial investigation, right after the incident occurred, in fact, but it's unclear if that plate number was documented. Again, and oddly, the Star-Telegram reported the man who approached Susie as Butler as a certainty, a fact, but Susie is sure the man who approached her was not Butler. There are several other suspects, or perhaps persons of interest, in Carol Pressler's murder investigation, but none who have been publicly named. Carol's violent death had a detrimental effect on her family, in seemingly endless ways. Her sister Susie still carries guilt, anger, and sadness. She fought for justice for many years. Susie once even reviewed the police file, which included the crime scene photographs, and saw what police had protected her from the day Carol's body was found. Her baby sister terrorized and brutally murdered.
She was a lot of fun. I mean, I could do anything with her. And as different as we were, I could look at her and know exactly what she was thinking. And we could finish each other's sentences. We might not agree with each other, but I could tell by the look on her face what she was thinking. And so it's tough. And it's tough because I don't know that I did all that much for her, but she was so, oh my God, what would I do without you? And I love you so much. And I mean, I wish I was the person she thought I was. But when that happened to her, there's just this feeling of knowing that some of her last thoughts would be, Susie, where are you? Because she thought I could save her always. And turns out you couldn't, you know?
Carol's nieces, who also dealt with the grief of losing their aunt to senseless violence, had to watch their mother in constant anguish and grow increasingly despondent as she watched the years go by without justice. The effects, Jody told us, did not stop there.
This pretty much destroyed my family. So from the age of 14, never feeling safe again, thinking that, you know, as a woman, you're not safe. Someone's going to murder you or rape you or get you. And honestly, we pretty much lost my mom at the same time because she was so traumatized that she really was not well and not, you know, she was just doing the best she could. But given the horrific nature of the crime and given how close we were and given how she had helped to raise Carol, you know, it just pretty much broke her. Understandably so.
Today, in 2022, as the Fort Worth Police Cold Case Unit actively investigates 27-year-old Carol Pressler's 1988 murder, evidence testing is a necessity. But while detectives wait for funding and then the testing itself, boots on the ground, traditional police work, is just as important.
I think that testing is definitely going to give us more information. I hate to make assumptions up front, but I'm very, very hopeful that with the amount of evidence we have, that something will yield information that will definitely help us, because they did collect quite a bit on this case. You know, we could wait on testing all day long, but testing can take a long time. So we still like to start interviewing and building up the investigation in the background. You know, the testing is what we rely on for making our case stronger, but it's not going to be the end-all be-all of what happens to the case. It's just going to give us more leads and more fingers to point and zero in on who actually was there with her that night. You know, there's quite a few suspects that were mentioned and talked about in the past. And, you know, ideally, we'll probably start there with some of her close connections, friends and family, obviously, but ex-boyfriends, because, you know, most murders are going to be personal on some level. And so we like to start with people that these victims knew. And just by the sheer fact that this happened in her apartment, it makes me believe that whoever was there with her was somebody that she knew and allowed into her apartment. So if she knew this person, you know, it may have been a friend or it may have been somebody that she was having some sort of romantic relationship with, you know, and those are some of the questions that we have. You know, it's been 34 years, so we're definitely going to reach out and see if there's anybody out there who might be able to fill in some of those gaps.
If you have any information about the murder of Carol Lee Pressler, now is the time to come forward. You can call Fort Worth Cold Case Detectives at 817-392-4307 or remain anonymous by calling Tarrant County Crime Stoppers at 817-469-8477. Special thanks to Susie, Jody, and Detective Leah Wagner for their invaluable contributions to this episode. Speaking of Fort Worth Cold Case Detectives, they could use your help. At the Fort Worth Cold Case Support Group's website, you can donate to help our city's diligent and determined cold case detectives solve their many unsolved cases. There are some special events in the works concerning the Fort Worth Cold Case Support Group, including something neat on the next episode of Gone Cold, so stay tuned for those. Nothing about cold case investigation is cheap, especially evidence testing, so please consider donating to this great cause. Erica and I would appreciate it immensely, as would our favorite detectives. You can support the show at patreon.com/Gone Cold Podcast, where you'll get the show ad-free. You can also support Gone Cold, Texas True Crime, by leaving us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes or whatever podcast app you listen on that has that feature. We appreciate y'all's support no matter how you do it. The Fort Worth Star-Telegram was used as a source for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.